Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Thank you for spending some time with me today. Country music, as Ken Burns tells it, is a uniquely American art form. Waylon, Willie, Dolly, Merle, Emmylou, Patsy, Hank, the Carter Family, Charlie Pride, Johnny Cash are all present in his new 16-hour documentary split into 8 episodes, which air on PBS. It spans a nearly 100-year music history, and the musicians are the historians and the witnesses. The film is produced with Ken Burns' longtime collaborator Dayton Duncan and Julie Dunphy. It features 3,200 archival photos and interviews with more than 100 people. Grammy Award-winning country music and bluegrass singer Kathy Mattea is one of them. Kathy and Ken are in studio. It's so nice to see you.
Nice to see you, Allison.
You're standing.
I'm still standing, yes.
You're still standing. So even a filmmaker of your caliber, 16 hours. How long did it take to make this film?
8.5 years, but it's not enough. I mean, whenever we do a series, Vietnam at 18 hours, jazz at 18 hours, people just come up and tell you. The only complaint we really get is what we've left out. Mm. And so you'd think that filmmaking is an additive process, like building a house. It's not. It's subtractive. We've got 1,000 hours of footage to get the few that are in the film. We've got 101 interviews to get, you know, the few hours of that in the film. We've got thousands and thousands of songs we've listened to get the 584 music cuts, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
When you went into your interviews with all of these well-known, fantastic artists, what kind of information did you want to get from them?
You know, we'd read about the arc of their biographies, but we were also interested because we started off with the presumption that this would be filled with lots of interviews with critics and writers and scholars and historians, and we've got one out of the 101 interviews. One is a great historian, Bill Malone. What was so amazing is that everybody from Kathy to Marty Stewart to Roseanne Cash to Ketch Secor, Rhiannon Giddens, Merle Haggard, who we got before he passed away, Willie Nelson, knew their history. And they didn't just want to talk about themselves. They wanted to talk about where this music came from. And they wanted to talk about the things that inspired them and what they liked about an earlier period and how tightly knit the family is in country music, not just among the real families like the Carters and the Cashes and the Williamses, but among the whole community of performers across that century, which makes this more suitable for Leo Tolstoy than for us, and also the extension to the fans, which is a unique relationship that's unlike any other musical form where you actually see the fans and interact with them. And Kathy, in our last episode, has this remarkable, moving bite about how it is that people come to see you and you have to see them. Our last episode is called Don't Get Above Your Raisin, meaning don't get too big for your britches. And there are very few folks, at least in the period that we cover, that are too big for their britches.
Mm. It's interesting hearing you describe it and describing the way the musicians wanted to tell you about the history and wanted to kind of relive it with you. It's sounds like the country music history is an oral tradition in some ways.
It's very much that. And if you think about it, country music is born as we know it because there's, first of all, phonographs that have been around for a few decades, but now there's this thing called radio that's going to disseminate it. But that doesn't mean the elements of country music haven't been around in white and African-American American households for a super long time, and it's the way you carry the news. It's down generations and across the porch and across the parlor and across the dance hall, across the church to the next pew. It's how you talk to your neighbors, and I think the intimacy of that and the universal themes of love and loss that are about the whole thing are the reason why country music is so popular and so enduring, because it is speaking about truth, what human beings experience. When Hank Williams said, "I'm so lonesome, I could cry," there's nobody on this planet that doesn't know what he's talking about. And that's distilled poetry with music, which is the fastest art form there is. It gets to you quicker than anything. Mm-hmm. And that's why we dove into it. It's the stories, and then you find out the stories of the people like Kathy or Roseanne Cash or Dolly Parton, and when you understand why Dolly wrote I Will Always Love You, her version sort of outgrows even Whitney Houston's spectacular cover. And taking nothing away from Whitney, you knowing the story, it enlarges the meaning of the music itself. And that's why we've been pigs in you-know-what for the last 8.5 years. Or maybe I should just say in clover.
In clover. Kathy, you tell a great story about one of the ways in which you learned country music history when you were a young waitress.
Oh, I was actually a tour guide.
Tour guide.
At the Country Music Hall of Fame.
That's it.
And it's okay. My job after that was a waitress.
Was a waitress. Yeah.
But I was too young to wait tables when I was 19 when I moved to Nashville. So I got this job as a tour guide. And so we had to learn the history. Like, we had little tiny dioramas, 3D versions of the Bristol Sessions. And we learned everything from the Bristol Sessions to the Outlaw Movement and Waylon and Willie, you know, saying, screw you guys, we're going to Texas and going to do it our own way. And I discovered we had these old newsreel films. So I would go and I just became eaten up with all these. It was like discovering a world I didn't know existed. So, I mean, really, I discovered Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys. And I was like, what? Who is Tommy Duncan? And what? Who is Leon McAuliffe? And I was like, this is jazz, but it's country. How does he do that? And we had films of them. I would just go play them over and over and over. We had Gene Autry. And we had Jimmy Rogers doing Blue Yodel number 2, I think it was, T for Texas. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, it was a direct, there was no filter. I just got thrown in the deep end of the pool. And it was a revelation for me.
What impact do you think that had on your career?
Oh, I think it made all the difference in the world. Mm-hmm. I think it gave me a sense of my roots. It gave me a sense, you know, one of the things Ken was talking about, everybody knowing their history. Country music to me is such a democratic kind of music because, you know, as is quoted a lot, Harlan Howard said it's three chords and the truth. It's got a simplicity where you can enter. So anyone can enter a bluegrass jam. And when you're young and you grow up in the mountains in Appalachia, where I grew up, you're taught the traditional songs. So you sit in and that's your entry. And you sit with the older folks and they pass down these songs. And you begin to be with them and you begin to pick up licks and musical vocabulary as well as these kinds of, you sit in a bluegrass jam even today and these songs from decades and decades and decades ago are the common ground where the musicians meet each other when they don't know each other. It's just it's a beautiful thing. It changed everything for me.
My guests are Ken Burns and Kathy Matea. We're talking about the new country music documentary that's airing on PBS. It's interesting when you said the three chords and the truth. Have you seen the movie Wild Rose yet? Okay, so this movie Wild Rose is, it's got some music written in it by Mary Steenburgen. It's about a Scottish woman who wants to come to Nashville to be a country music star. And she sees it as her way out. She's just gotten out of prison. She sees it a better life for her kids. And with this heavy Scottish accent, she just says, I'm an American. Like that show, they said, why do you keep wanting to go to America? She's like, because I'm an American. Like, she believes it, which makes me wonder, what is it about country music that it is American?
Like that. Well, it's the story of people who built this country, as Rhiannon Giddens said. These are poor people, middle class at best, lower middle class at best, poor people who actually built this nation, who understood, black and white, who understood that the main advertisement to the United States isn't quite true. It's not a level playing field. And stuff happens. Hard times visit you. Economic hard times, emotional hard times visit you. And so the music is a pure expression of that. And so we tend to think country music now, we categorize it, and we it's not an island nation separated from everything else that requires a visa or a passport. It has been connected to the blues and jazz and rhythm and blues. And with rhythm and blues, it is they are the parents of rock and roll. So it's connected to rock and roll and to folk and to gospel and to pop and to rap and to hip hop and to classical. And it is completely one element in a very complex molecule of American music. But I think what distinguishes it and what makes it so popular is that it reminds us that these are the pleas and the laments and the celebrations of people who don't always get their story told. Mm-hmm. And so they feel compelled to tell those stories. And it's a very, very powerful medicine. I mean, one of the great themes that I hadn't expected was about class. That is to say, how many of the great country singer-songwriters were born into a stultifying poverty? And then you begin to realize the friction on them produces a kind of creative, you know, energy, and they're able to escape the specific gravity of those privations and those traumas and help the rest of us who don't necessarily get to go along dream the dreams of escape as well. And it's a really beautiful thing, because it's not a fantasy escape. It's an escape into, you know, I've got a hot rod Ford and a $2 bill, and I know a place right over the hill. Meaning, you know, hey, good looking, my Hank Williams. It's just ordinary pleasures of life and what seems to us ordinary sorrows. But when you're touched by I'm So Lonesome, like you see the silence of a falling star lights up a purple sky, and as I wonder where you are, I'm so lonesome I could cry, you know, suddenly you go, whoa, this is the language that I understand. This is speaking to me.
One of the things I love about the film, we do this deep cultural and archaeological dive, but there's these great moments of levity and these nuggets. And this one I've been obsessed with. I've been telling everybody I pulled. Johnny Cash making fun of Elvis Presley.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He called him the old man. Elvis called Johnny the old man because he had 3 years on him. But he called Elvis the shaky kid when they were traveling in the Southwest and being on the Louisiana hayride together before Elvis, very interesting and paradoxically, leaves country behind because he's most definitely, in a way, not country. He's something new, but then gets stuck through the managership of Tom Parker, but for other reasons. Known only to Elvis and now the rest of us and, you know, many, many stories. Johnny stays still in country and moves everywhere, embraces every kind of music, embraces every kind of cause, is curious about every kind of person in America, and particularly those people who are left behind, Native Americans and prisoners. And it's a kind of testament for the guy who did not go and leave country behind to have touched every corner. And he's a guy, as a child of rock and roll and R&B, who crossed over. We knew everything that Johnny did.
I do want to play this for our listeners.
Yeah.
This is Johnny Cash doing his very best Elvis Presley.
Well, it's down at the end of 40th Street at the Heartbreak Hotel. You'll be so lonely, you'll be so lonely, you could die.
That's just one of the many nuggets you'll find in country music, Ken Burns' new documentary. There's just something so sort of, I know it's planned, but it's very spontaneous about that to me, and gave me a window into Johnny Cash I hadn't thought about before.
So if this is the music very often of the dispossessed or the economically disadvantaged, there's a kind of us against them mentality, and that provides a kind of freshness, a devil may care, you know, I don't have to stand on ceremony here. I don't have to wonder who's watching. And so you do get these great things. You know, Roger Miller came from this tiny, tiny little town in Oklahoma, and he said it was so small that we didn't have a town drunk, so we all took turns. Which, if you think about it, has layers and layers of first humor and then tragedy to it. And that may be the beginning of a country music song. You know what I mean? It's certainly Roger Miller's life, who was able to keep the humor on the surface, but it masked deep, deep wounds.
And he was much like Hank Williams in that way. Hank Williams had this twinkle, hey, good looking, what you got cooking, jambalaya, all those very clever, fun songs. And then he would go to the other extreme, and Roger Miller was the same way.
Exactly.
Who were some of the artists who inspired you, Kathy?
Oh my gosh. Well, you know, I got it. I was like this sponge when I was a kid. And when I got into college, I found a bunch of people who were as eaten up about music as I was. And so we got in, they turned me on to bluegrass music, which I'd been exposed to in high school. So like the Will the Circle Be Unbroken album came out while I was in college. And this was the people in my generation going back and leading us back to the people before them. Emmylou Harris, you know, is an icon for anyone my age in country music. We all look up to her. So she was going and doing the songs from the generations before. Linda Ronstadt was doing the same thing. And so those people led us back to our roots. And that was a real gift. I think, you know, for me, in a lot of ways, I look back and there was just a lot of serendipitous stuff that just happened to me that helped me know where I came from. And when I, you know, there was this moment, I had heard Hank Williams when I was young, and I thought, well, he's really good, but there was this moment when I got it, when I was working at the Hall of Fame, and I saw some old film, and I thought, he was the first rock and roll star, really. People would scream through his whole show, like the Beatles. He got 5 encores, I think, the first time he was on the Opry. And there is an edge to his voice that it does that thing in your gut, you know? It's the blues in there. And these kinds of things, being led back to them, I think it changed everything about how I approached music.
I want to play a little bit of the Carter Family singing Can the Circle Be Unbroken? Mm-hmm. And we'll talk about it on the other side.
I was standing by the window on one cold and cloudy day, and I saw the hearse come rolling for to carry my mother away.
They're the first family of country, is that fair to say?
Yep.
Why?
Easily. Well, they're there in 1927 when Ralph Peer, on successive sessions on August 1st, 1927, records the Carter Family, AP, but more importantly, Sarah and Maybelle. Maybelle's the original American lead guitarist, and Sarah's got sort of this voice that comes out of the rock formations, Roseanne Cash says, this keening voice that is all kind of plaintive and whatever. And then on August 4th, he records Jimmy Rogers, who comes from the South, who's steeped in the African-American blues of the all-black train crews that are laying track in southern Mississippi, and he's a water boy. And he comes up and he brings that, and the Carter family's been traveling around, AP's been traveling around Appalachia with Leslie Riddle, who's a black slide guitarist, and they're borrowing stuff from the African-American church and reworking it into their own stuff. They're really the Sunday morning of this story. Jimmy Rogers is the Saturday night, and that tension suffuses jazz and R&B and the blues and everything else. But that's there. The Carter Family is the beginning of the beginning. Once we're disseminating this music that heretofore has just been traveling across a holler or, you know, across a porch.
My guests are Ken Burns and Kathy Matea. We're talking about the new 16-hour documentary, Country Music. We'll have more after a quick break. It's okay, we can talk off mic. We're back. This is All of It on WNYC. My guests are Ken Burns and Kathy Matea. We're talking about country music, Ken's new 16-hour documentary, which is airing on PBS. See, country music makes you got to keep talking about it.
Oh, it's all about talking.
Let's talk about women in country. Yeah. They've featured prominently in the documentary. Was that just because that's the way it is, or is that because that was something that you, Ken, wanted to make sure happened?
Well, you know, we don't ever want to impose on the subject. If we're going to do a deep dive in American history in any subject, we're going to bump into the stuff that we are about. And race is clearly one of them. Class is one of them. And in the case of country music, this is about women from the very, very beginning being a hugely important factor, which is not true in the fraternity of jazz. Mm-hmm. And not, I mean, you basically let in Ella and Billy and Sarah into jazz, but it's a fraternity. This is not, until recently.
Until recently, yeah.
Until recently been a fraternity, although in the 60s, you know, you see the vestiges of that as women are trying to break out. They're also being corralled and contained. I'll shut up because I don't really have qualifications to talk about it. But suffice to say, there are amazing stories about amazingly strong women talking about things in their music and their art that nobody in rock and roll or folk are dealing with. And that's a surprising thing because of the conventional wisdom that suggests that this hayseed backward music is exactly that, and it ain't.
Why were women so integral from the beginning?
Because they were making the music. And, you know, when you're sitting on a porch, when most of this music started on porches and in hollows and when people were working, and they were a way to have community when there was no radio or people couldn't get the, like where I'm from, you couldn't get radio in much of the state, let alone anything else. And so people, that's how community was formed. So people didn't say, oh, you don't get in because you're female. Anybody who sang or had a guitar was part of the circle. And I think it came out of that. And then as the next layer of musicians began to add their layer onto the tradition, they started writing their own songs from these experiences and from where they came from and building on these traditional songs that they were taught. And so someone like Loretta Lynn, someone like Dolly Parton, they're writing songs about their experience, and they're very strong, driven, and they have passion about music and life and where they think they can go. And so they're telling their own stories, and it begins to change the conversation.
Well, let's actually take a listen to a clip from Loretta Lynn from the documentary talking about writing songs.
You don't write about fantasies. You write about life and true life. What was going on that day? That's the way I did it. Just life. I mean, the songs are just life. It's I've seen it or I've lived it. And I never would tell my husband which one was.
Well, it's interesting. We learned in the documentary that the great Owen Bradley, her producer, said that the Nashville sound wasn't going to cut it for Loretta.
Right.
Why?
Well, the Nashville sound was a response to the fact that country music sales were really plummeting after the birth of rock and roll. So in the mid to late 50s, both Owen Bradley, a great producer, and Chet Atkins, another producer on Music Row, began to smooth out country's rougher edges and added strings instead of fiddles and backup choruses and choirs instead of the usual nasal harmonies that characterize it, and had a lot of success. Crazy, Willie Nelson, is Patsy Cline is a classic Nashville sound. But that was a square peg into which the round hole of Loretta Lynn was not going to fit. And it is to Owen Bradley's credit that he understood that and said, we cannot push her in this way. She's not doing anything. And if she writes what's in her heart, it's going to come out. And so you've got You're Not Woman Enough to Take My Man. And the next song is Don't Come Home A-Drinkin' With Lovin' On Your Mind, which is nobody in rock is saying anything like that. And then she follows it with the pill. She's not going to be a brooder hen and pop out a baby every year, and we're done with this. I'm taking the pill. This is wildly controversial for any woman to be singing this in the mid to late 60s, let alone a country person. In fact, there was an effort to ban her on some of the more conservative country stations, and of course that just boosted the sales.
You mentioned producers. That's one of the questions I wanted to ask you. We've been talking about the artists a lot and the songwriters a lot. Where do record producers fit into this story for you?
This is a huge one, and I'll let Kathy talk about this because she had a great producer, Alan, and he's seminal to a lot of really good people, and that can be the difference. The producer that makes you sing what they think you should sing, and the producer who sees who you are and insists on you being who you are, is a great gift to any artist, I would say. And it's somebody, it's like a therapist in another, if you've got a good producer, it's the therapy that sets up a kind of independent witness.
Yeah, a producer for a record is like a director is for a movie, basically. And you're in there to sort of create the atmosphere that brings out the best in everybody. And some producers you hire because they have their own sound and that's what you want and you fit yourself into their box. And some producers like Alan Reynolds, who did me, and Garth Brooks and Don Williams and Crystal Gayle and lots of people along the way, was a different kind of guy. It was more, he held a kind of presence and he would just say one or two little things and everybody would step up their game. And you just, you just the level of trust was amazing with him. And you know, Chet Atkins and Owen Bradley really built Nashville and built the Nashville Sound, built Music Row, built studios there, and we're very, very responsible for a lot of what we think of as classic country. But the industry itself was much smaller in those days, and so it, you know, this the voice was more contained and louder. So these two men built much of what the rest of us built what we did on.
Well, let's take a little listen to Kathy Mattea, shall we? This is on the Spotify playlist that goes along with the documentary, which is really cool. So let's listen.
Claire had all but given up when she and Edwin fell in love. She touched his face and shook her head in disbelief. She sighed and said, in many dreams I've held you near. Now at last you're really here. Where have you been? I've looked for you forever.
It's lovely. My guests are Kathy Mattea and Ken Burns. You mentioned race. We got to talk about Charlie Pride.
Yeah.
It's an incredibly interesting part of the documentary. Especially the story where they didn't tell the audience that Charlie Pride was black. And then we walked on stage, what happened to him. When you think about Charlie Pride's place in country music and the way this country has dealt with race, what's his legacy, do you think?
It's huge. I mean, he's not the first great black star. That's Dee Ford Bailey, who's a harmonica player in the 30s on the Grand Ole Opry and was one of the most popular ones until he was summarily fired for reasons of the color of his skin and not the content of his character. But Charlie Pride comes in the decade of the 60s. He's recognized. They assign an important producer, Cowboy Jack Clement, to sort of walk him through. He's got to negotiate a minefield of potential racial backlash. They don't they don't send the picture to the label until they love what they're hearing. He's got, you know, pipes from heaven. And then he takes off. I mean, it's both a cautionary tale of how brutal it can be for women, for African Americans, for others who don't fit in. But it also reminds you that there are gaps in all of this, and sometimes talent will out. And I think Charlie Pride got 29, I think, number one hits. He was the first CMA artist of any color to win the Male Vocalist of the Year two years in a row. That had not happened before Charlie. He actually took the bull by the horns and confronted somebody that could have presented a real obstacle to him, Farron Young. The implication being is that his he was a more unreconstructed brethren, shall we say, but they met on a kind of battlefield of talent and worked it out pretty quickly and then became lifelong friends. And it just reminds you that when we spend our time focusing on merely the oppositional, we forget to select for at least the possibility, I don't mean to sugarcoat this, at least the possibility of some transformation happening. That people, you know, when Jackie Robinson comes up and you're a Brooklyn Dodger fan and you're a racist, what can you do? Change teams? It's going to catch up to you. Change sports? It's going to catch up to you. Or you can change.
It's interesting you brought up Jackie Robinson, because I found with Charlie Pride, he in the way that Jackie Robinson, he had a certain temperament.
That's it. That's exactly what I was
going to
say.
And he had a lot of grace and not a lot of bitterness. And this story that we have queued up, which is in the documentary, really, really shows that.
I said, ladies and gentlemen, I realize it's kind of unique, me coming out here on a country music show wearing this permanent tan. The minute I said that, a big applause. So I guess they said, well, let's sit back and see what he got to offer.
I thought I had seen pretty girls in my time.
Kathy, you were going to say.
I was just going to say, you know, it's partly his personality and how he handled it. He owns it, but he doesn't wear it like a, he doesn't, it's not heavy on him. So he has this way of sort of being, I mean, when you meet him, he's the warmest person. And he doesn't wear it like a badge. It's just, there's something sort of, he lets it have its gravitas and he tells the stories, but it's also, he's able to wear it loosely enough that he can make changes like what happened with Farron Young. He's just that kind of guy.
I don't want to give away everything in the documentary, so I'm going to have to wrap up in a minute.
But I just want to say Hank Williams dies and Patsy Cline dies, but that's already happened this week. Spoiler alert.
You decided you wrap up in 96. What was it about that year?
You know, we need to, as historians, have some distance from the present moment. That's the province of journalism and the historians that deal with the near past. It's the height of Garth's popularity, Garth Brooks' mm-hmm. popularity. It's when Bill Monroe, who's been present in our series since the second episode, dies and also influences two of his acolytes, Marty Stewart and Ricky Skaggs, to sort of reexamine their own path. And then, in fact, the film doesn't really stop its narrative track until we, in a final chapter, deal with the final years of Johnny Cash, who in the beginning of the last episode is fired by his record label, Columbia, shocking everyone, and then finds, they say that an apple tree produces its best fruit in its last year. And what happens to Johnny is he meets a hip-hop and rap producer, Rick Rubin. And then all of a sudden, things happen, and Rick Rubin, like great producers, allows Johnny Cash to be Johnny Cash. And the last few years are that great flowering and the great reminder and all of the pathos of everything he carries. And what he carries is, of course, not just the arc of his story, which begins in our fourth episode, but the arc of the family he marries into, the Carter family, which is at the beginning. So the Carters and the Cashes are the great parentheses of ours. And that's a good place. And we don't need to fight any of the contemporary battles because history doesn't repeat itself, as Mark Twain suggested, it rhymes. So everything that you see today, from Little Nas X to women being shut out of country music to Dixie Chicks and whoever else is opposed to politics and whatever, has been going on since the very beginning. And so our mic drop moment is, of course, Little Nas X, because you're saying, are you surprised by the fact that a black gay rapper has got the number one country song of all time? Nope.
The name of the documentary is Country Music. It is airing on PBS. Ken Burns and Kathy Matea, thanks for spending so much time with me today.
Thank you, Alison.
Thank you very much.
Going out on some Dolly.
Jolene, I'm begging of you, please don't take my man. Jolene.
The Open Ears Project is a brand new daily podcast that our colleagues at WNYC Studios and WQXR launched last week. It features a new guest every day talking about the piece of classical music that means the most to them. The Guardian newspaper describes it as, quote, a regular ritual worth joining, and we'll be following along on all of it throughout the season. This is day 5.
I mean, tell me this doesn't make you want to jump out of your seat and dance. I'm like, I want to live like someone who is living in this piece all the time, who is perpetually joyful in adversity. I am Aminat Tussaud. I'm an author and a host. I host a podcast called Call Your Girlfriend and, you know, just a lady around town. We're listening to the Juba Dance by Florence Price from her first symphony. I was 33 years old. It was quite recent. And I'd been sick for a really long time. I had a sense that I was getting a lot of bad news. So I said the word cancer before the doctor because doctors are very sensitive human beings. I am not that way. So I was like, yes, let's get on with it. Tell me what's wrong. And I just remember looking at my really, truly wonderful gynecologist and thinking like, wow, this is very hard for her. And I had my phone and my headphones. I had been listening to a classical playlist and it ended, and then this was the next thing that it served me. And I remember it was very joyful and it was very defiant, and it felt really romantic to me in this like very big way. And it really just imprinted on my brain that day. I was like, this is the mood. This is the mood we are going for. Everybody else is borderline tears. They're whispering to you. They don't know what to tell you. Because I was very excited. I was like, oh my God, let me tell you. I finally have a thing that I know what it is. It's cancer. It's great. And people don't like to hear that. I was like, Juba dance. It just became the background to illness for me. There was something really spiritual about it, and I am not a very spiritual person, so it is very strange to me that I heard that. I heard religion and comfort and resilience immediately, and I heard exactly what I needed to hear. I didn't know anything about the composer, Florence Price, and frankly, I didn't know anything about the Juba dance, and I was shocked to find out that she was African-American and started reading up more about the Juba, which is a dance essentially that was brought over by enslaved people to America. People would perform to indicate like moments of joy and moments of resistance and resilience because there was so much they were not allowed to do. And even in the midst of really awful experiences, there can be something that brings you happiness and joy. And it is now part of the soundtrack of my life.
Aminantu So chose the Juba Dance by Florence Price from the Symphony No. 1. And if you want to hear the track in full, go to openearsproject.org, where you can also sign up for the Daily Companion email newsletter for more information about the music. Subscribe to the Open Ears Project for free wherever you get your podcasts. In the next episode, a former guest on this show, novelist and screenwriter Ian McEwan, talking about the death of his best friend, Christopher Hitchens, and the Bach Double Violin Concerto. This is all of it on WNYC. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.